棒吗？哦，是。对嘛，这边，这边，请贵人把和尚读起吧，你过来吧。
So we are on the section on eliminating too much application of the antidotes to the mental excitement and mental thinking or laxity. So, through one's own experience, one would be able to tell when you should not put any extra effort, excessive effort. Experience of at the end of the eighth mental step to calm abiding, and one would know that one's mind is not either sunken by mental laxity or distracted by mental excitation. And so at that point, one should not put excess effort in applying the antidote to these two obstacles, which are no more harming your experience of being able to stay equipoised on the object.
So having understood what has been explained above, then one should choose one's object that you want to focus your mind on to develop single-pointed concentration. And then try to focus your mind on the objects that you have chosen, for example, a statue of or image of a Buddha. First of all, you need to look at the image of the Buddha again and again, and then also see the details of the Buddha's other attributes, like the protrusion, crown protrusion, and the eyes, hands, and the manner of sitting, and so forth. And so if you focus on the sitting Buddha, once you have started your meditation, you should not change your focus from a sitting Buddha to a standing one. So you should not think that although I'm imagining the Buddha is here, the Buddha doesn't really and is not present here.
Mm-hmm.
So even when you go into the detailed attributes of the Buddha, you should have a clear idea of even the eyes, the parts of the eyes that being unmixed or the pupil and the other parts, the white part and the black parts of the eyes are not mixed. So, of course, in today's world, we have lots of automatic machines, electronics, and right at the press of one button, you can actually make them work. So, and because of such easy way of dealing with things, people also think that these inner realizations may also be, they may be able to realize them rather quickly without much effort. So on the one hand, of course, when you want to make changes in the material world outside, it takes time. But then merely by changing your own outlook on things, you may be able to change your attitude towards them. And so it seems easier to deal with. But with regard to the negative emotions, we are used to them for so long that we won't be able to overcome them easily, and so one should not be expect to make change with transformation within your mind very quickly and easily. So you should sit on a very comfortable seat, smooth or soft, and so the seat should be higher at the rear side. And for example, like at the rear side, maybe the cushion should be four finger widths high and higher. And then your eyes should focus on the tip of the nose, and then your spine should be straight. And then the hands should be in the meditation posture, and your tip of the nose should, if you actually were to draw a line from the tip of the nose to the navel, I mean, you should have that kind of a straight line, and so the head should be slightly bent, and then you should breathe rather softly and naturally, and hold your mouth and tongues and so forth in the right position. So sometimes in order to calm your mind, you may, if you are emotionally agitated, then you should do breathing meditation. Just breathe in and out and then count the breathings, and so your breath, and then it will help to calm your mind. Once it's settled, then you should go on with the concentration practice. So with regard to the experience of single-pointed concentration, we need to develop what are known as the physical and mental pliancy and so forth. So these, of course, because we don't have the single-pointed concentration yet, I mean, they may be found a little bit difficult to explain. So once you have developed, if you have developed some experience of bodhicitta and the view of emptiness and so forth, and then when you want to really focus your mind single-pointedly, you will see how it's necessary to have that in order for you to actually progress to the higher levels of the path, such as the path of preparation and so forth. And therefore, you should have you should develop this delight in the developing the single-pointed concentration. And so you should then, as part in, in the process of developing this concentration, you should imagine a Buddha's image at the height of your forehead, a small one. But if you have difficulty imagining a small statue or image of a Buddha in front of, then you should have a bigger one. And so that is the focus of your meditation, the object. If you have a smaller image, then it will help to develop a very clear concentration. And if you have a bigger one, then it will actually make the mind slightly dull or slackened, and will not help. And the image should be bright, and also it will help not to develop this mental sinking. And if it's heavy, then it will help the mind not to get distracted. So you should be mindful of that focus, the object that you are focusing mind you are on, and then you should have clarity of the object and as well as clarity in the mind itself. And so there should be an intense clarity. So if you make your mind too tight when you do this kind of meditation, then you will develop some kind of an imbalance in the wind problem. Then you'll feel agitated on the upper part of your body. So when you're able to stay on the object for some time, to a certain degree, then you can also do this introspective meditation. So you should also be able to recognize when the mental excitation and mental laxity happen. Although you may have some kind of a clarity of object in your mind, but if there is no intensity in the mind with regard to the mental clarity, then there is a risk of falling into experiencing mental laxity. Therefore, you must be able to recognize such obstacles. So Chandra Gomi has said that if you push yourself too much, then you will cause yourself, your mind, to have mental excitation. Whereas if you are too slackened, then you will develop mental laxity, and therefore you should be able to walk this fine line between these two. So, during the first mental step, your mind will not stay on the object, but all kinds of thought processes and preconceptions and so forth would arise as if like a rain of thoughts were pouring. So this is because you have not familiarized your mind with single point and concentration before, and therefore, whereas you already have this kind of distraction and all this kind of thoughts going on in your mind all the time, you have not been able to recognize it until that point, and therefore it is not an obstacle, but you are now able to recognize these distractions and so forth happening in your mind when you try to focus your mind on the object.
Then, once you are able to stay on the object after pushing yourself slightly with the first step, then you will be able to stay on the object for some time. When that is developed, you will sometimes feel relaxed, at other times feel that your mind is distracted and so forth. And so, therefore, you are able to, at that point, develop the second step called continuous placement. And then, when you further acquaint your mind with the meditation, whereas you may be able to stay, you may be distracted when there is some kind of a distracting condition, and whereas you are able to stay on the object, but then slightly feel tired, and so you are able to, at this point, you are able to stay on the object more time than before, and the distraction becomes less. And so this is called patched placement. It's like putting a patch onto a cloth. You have the basic cloth there, and which is torn, and therefore you put a patch on it. So the basic mind is able to stay on the object basically, but then it's slightly distracted sometimes, and then you need to bring it back. That's therefore it's called patched placement. So from the third to the seventh mental engagement the steps, you need to use the mental engagement for attention. So at the eighth step, then you'll be able to stay on the object without the obstacle. And then at the ninth, with the help of the spontaneous attention, you are able to stay on the object without any obstacle or effortlessly. So these nine steps that are mentioned here are called placing the mind, and then the placing the mind continuously, and then the placing the mind in a patch-like manner, and then the fourth is placing the mind closely, and then the fifth is calming the mind, and then sixth is pacifying the mind, and seventh pacifying the mind completely, and the eighth step is the placing the mind in single-pointedly, and then placing the mind equally. And so once you have developed that, then you will be able to develop what are known as this the pliancy of body and mind.
So first you develop, once having developed that ninth state, then you will have developed the mental pliancy, and then that in turn induces the physical pliancy, and then that in turn brings about what is known as the bliss of mental pliancy. Then you feel some kind of ecstasy through the mental physical pliancy. But when you develop the unwavering pliancy, that is when you develop the calm abiding mind. So when you develop the extra special bliss of physical and mental pliancy, then you have developed the calm abiding and or shamatha, and you have also attained what is known as the preparatory stage of the first concentration realm. So this alone, of course, cannot overpower the negative emotions, the active negative emotions in us. So there is a qualm raised after having said, so if that is the case, it says in the earlier it was said that once you actually with the help of this the higher concentration, the higher training of concentration and the calm abiding, you'll be able to overpower the negative emotions. And so it is contradictory to that statement. So that is from the point of view of even including the shamatha or vipassana, which is mundane. So we are now switching to the southern lineage. Southern lineage on page 236 in the new revised edition. The title is on the perfection of concentration, the ornament of Maya Sutra say, the place where the intelligent practice is one easily supplied, a safe site and a healthy spot with good companions and the requisites for a meditator's success. Once you have found such a place, sit on a comfortable seat in the seven-point Varachana posture. Take as your meditational object and the breathing in and out slowly by training in the nine states, mental placement and so forth. And the end or in the four attentions, mental pliancy will arise on that basis, physical pliancy will be there. And subsequently you will achieve immovable pliancy, which coincides with the attainment of meditative serenity. By pursuing your training in the path, you achieve the fruits of meditative serenity, the various kinds of clairvoyance, supernormal powers and so forth, so on. Now we moved on to the swift path, or the quick path by Benjin Lobsang Yishi. So again, it says the second training in the two perfections. There are two parts in it. Training in the how to train in the calm abiding, or which is the nature of concentration, and how to train in the vipassana or insight, special insight, which is the nature of wisdom. And so regarding these two, the first one has in turn two parts, and how to train, how to practice during the actual session, and what to do during the post-meditation session. And with regard to the first, there are three preparation, actual practice, and then the conclusion. With regard to the first, and so you should have done the practices of the preliminary practices in general, and in particular those attitudes that are developed through the during the beings of intermediate scope. And so with regard here, there is a mention of arising yourself or visualizing yourself, transforming into a deity. So for this, of course, you should, to be able to do that, you should have received the tantric initiations of the action tantra upwards, without which you cannot do deity yoga practice. So one should keep one's morality pure and stay in a very good place, which is conducive to your mind for concentration. And then it should be a place where there are not many people passing by, or you are not in the company of many people. And then you should also give up thoughts to of much desire and greed. You should live a very contented life without much want, and sit on a very comfortable seat with the body straight, the legs in the Vajra cross-legged posture, and then the two hands in the meditation posture. And then you should breathe rather slowly and gently, And so you should, in other words, get together all the requisites, prerequisites for these concentration practice. So although, and then regarding the actual meditation session itself, and although there are many different objects for your focus of to cultivate this calm abiding or this meditative serenity, the best is to use a Buddha image. And so it's best to use an image of a deity or the Buddha. So when you focus your mind on the mind itself for this kind of practice, you need to be mindful. And so the very nature of the mind itself is luminous or clear and awareness. So you should remind yourself of this nature. So here it is the meditation using one's own mind is in accordance with the Mahamudra practice of developing, trying to cultivate and develop shamatha based on your mind, focusing on your mind itself. So with regard to this, using the mind itself as the focus of meditation, it is also mentioned in the smaller stages of the path by Master Tsongkhapa. So with regard to thoughtlessness, one first determines that one will not distract minds anywhere else but the mind, and then use mindfulness. Show mindfulness. So regarding mindfulness, you are actually acquainting your mind with that object or the focus that you have chosen to focus your mind on. So if you were to develop a very perfect concentration, single-pointed concentration, you should overcome the five obstacles. Forgetting the instructions that you have received as to how to go about with such the development of such concentration. You should overcome these five obstacles by applying what are known as the five antidotes, eight antidotes. So you should also have the determination or the wish to develop the concentration and have the interest in doing so and so forth. Once you develop the instruction, develop this kind of interest, then you should not forget the instructions as to how to develop the concentration. And then when you're in the process of developing concentration, you are what is known as the cloudiness and laxity fall on your mind. So the distinction between these two is also drawn, explained.
Gurbe, Gurbala,
So the mental cloudiness is there is when you have some kind of a heaviness in your mind, and where the object that you are focusing on is not clear to your mind, and so you feel this heaviness in the mind and body. Whereas so this kind of cloudiness is falls within the category of ignorance, and there is a kind of a darkness falling on the mind. And although, and on the other hand, although your mind may not be distracted, have been distracted, but there is no clarity, and also intensity of clarity of the mind. And also your mindfulness, the strength of mindfulness, it's not so strong and clear. And so at that point, have developed a very gross level or state of mental laxity. Although there may be some clarity and brightness in the mind, there is no tautness as to be able to tautness in being able to ascertain your own object of focus, which is slightly slackened, and so that is subtle mental laxity. So when these befall, then you should remind yourself of the qualities of the three as antidote, the qualities of the three jewels. And then you should also bring up in your mind the sense of light, and also you should practice the instructions as to how to mix your mind with the space and so forth. And so blessing for the tea. So regarding this instruction, you imagine at your navel a pinkish kind of a ball of light or drop, which is a size of a bird's egg, and then that is you should actually imagine that it actually shoots up through your body and goes out of your body into the space. In empty space, and thereby you should imagine that this merges with the space, and then focus your mind single-pointedly on it. So this is said to be similar to the opening the door of the space where your mind and the space mix. So not being able to stay on that focus or single-pointedly, but slightly, when you are slightly distracted, then that is mental distraction, excitement. And for that, you need to show mindfulness and introspection or vigilance. And although you show, despite doing that, if your mind still goes after an object of desire, that is actually mental distraction,
mental distraction called as excitement, which is a gross form of mental excitement, and therefore, for as antidote to that, you should meditate on impermanence, and also the sufferings of lower unfortunate realms, and also the samsara, the suffering of samsara, and through these forcibly sever your mental excitement. Then we are now at the training, how to train and special insight, nature of wisdom. So with regard to the preliminary, as explained during the cultivation of calm abiding or shamatha, and it is the same as what is explained then, and then especially by relying on qualified. So we have switched to the fifth Dalai Lama's text. Which is the sixth paramita, the perfection of wisdom. So we all consider education to be very important in order to make a living. Because if we remain ignorant, the ignorance is seen as something which is an obstacle to our living. Therefore, education is regarded very important and essential. So with regard to this wisdom, there's wisdom which realizes ultimate nature of things, and also the wisdom understanding the different fields of knowledge, the five fields of knowledge, through which one becomes a scholar. And and so wisdom is said to be the source of all excellent qualities that there are seen and unseen. And so in order to develop both, then one should uphold or embrace wisdom, it is said. In the 100 text on the 100 verses on wisdom. And then the text which says, which is a praise to the praiseworthy one, it says that. So people who are blinded by ignorance, without knowing the truth, they may go up to the peak of cyclic existence, but then they suffer again and fall into the fall in samsara again. And so such practitioners who may have developed the concentrations up to the and overcome the active kind of negative emotions up to the nothingness, formless realm called nothingness. And then, after that, they may reach the peak of existence, but they are still not, they have not become free from samsara.
And therefore, the king of the concentration sutra says they may develop the concentration, single-pointed concentration, but because of not having overcome the grasping at self or perception of self, they are again disturbed by negative emotions, like the practitioner Udaka, and having developed concentration. So because of not having overcome the grasping at self, Udaka, a non-Buddhist practitioner, his mind was disturbed by the negative emotions, and then his mind actually devolved into the lower levels of within samsara. And therefore, this kind of concentration is not something which is not the goal of beings of great capacity. So, in that case, there's a calm raised. In that case, it is not, is it not meaningful to develop the concentration that was the shamatha, calm abiding, that was explained earlier? Then an answer to that, it is said, those who follow you, your teaching, although they may not have developed the first concentration, the actual concentration level of concentration absorption, but then they will be able to overcome the samsara, while the demons or devils may gaze at them. So with regard to understanding the selflessness of phenomena or emptiness, Master Adisha says that by following the commentaries or explanations of Chandrakirti, you will be able to gain insight into the emptiness as explained by Nagarjuna. And so, so with regard to selflessness, realization of the two types of selflessnesses, the 400 verses say that first you overcome or get rid of the non-meritorious actions, and then in the middle overcomes grasping at self of a person, and then at the end you can overcome the self grasping at selflessness self of phenomena. And so, regarding the first, the second verse, where it says, "In the middle, get rid of the grasping at self." This grasping at self is grasping at self of a person, which is at a grosser level. And then one develops the insight into the selflessness of phenomena. So once you have realized fully the selflessness of persons, then
when having realized that, when you actually shift your focus to phenomena such as your body, the aggregates and so forth, if you are able to develop the same kind of insight, then that is when you the indication that you have realized the selflessness of persons fully. So then the 400 verses also says that by overcoming ignorance, you'll be able to overcome all the rest of the negative emotions. And it's like the ignorance is called analogous to the physical faculty, which pervades all the other sense faculties, such as an eye and ear and so forth. So once you have overcome grasping at self, then you will not have any kind of mistaken or misconceptions or distorted thoughts. And so all the faults of negative emotions arise from what is known as the view of transitory collection, and seeing this, then when you actually realize that this is the object of that view is self, then the yogi actually stops this grasping at the self, or rejects the self. And then this is said in Madhyamaka Avatara, and then Ratnavali says, as long as there is clinging to this aggregates, to that extent there will be a clinging to the self. And when there is clinging to a self, there is karma, and from karma comes birth. So with regard to the establishing the two selflessnesses, the Master Tsongkhapa, having received instruction from the Manjushri, applied the instructions and then gained the experience of the perfect view. And and then there are traditions coming from Master Tsongkhapa through Kedup Gelugpa Sang, which first goes through the preliminary practices and then the actual practice of developing the view of selflessness, whereas the tradition that comes through Kedup Sherab Singhi is the way to guide a disciple through what is known as the four mindfulnesses. So there is no difference whichever tradition lineage you follow, but here here, since we are going through the tradition of the Lamrim, the path, the stages of the path to enlightenment, pertaining to this perfection of wisdom, therefore we follow the preliminary practices, and as explained before,
so
So with regard to the line from Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka Avatara, where it says the yogis reject the self, so what happens to us is we have the sense of an I, and in relation, I mean, by seeing or having this view of our body and mind, and on the basis of that, we have a sense of an I. So within this self that appears to the self, to the mind, there is a self which appears to be substantially existent, and then a self which appears to have some inherent existence. So this kind of self does not seem to be to us as being as something which is designated by mind, but it seems as if this I is solidly existing. Therefore, we need to first recognize this self, how it appears to the mind. So when you actually check within yourself how the self exists, and then you will not be able to find anything that you can actually pinpoint as being the self or I. And when you are not able to find the self within these aggregates, but then the self does exist, then what you see is that it exists by way of designation, and only in name and designation the self exists. But then, although that is the fact, how the self appears to the mind is as if it has some kind of a solid, independent existence, and that is what you should affirm as the object of negation. When you try to prove selflessness, that self is what is known as the object of negation. So with regard to an I, there is an I which is merely designated, and then there is also the sense of I that we get, which is an independently existent I, and then another sense of I that is neither seen as being designated nor without any kind of attributions like that. So even though one may have realized emptiness, you still will have the sense of I'm going, I'm sitting, and so forth, without actually attributing to qualifying that sense with independently existent self or merely designated self or anything like that. So although we may have this kind of very strong sense of self and clinging to the self, still the self is like a mirror, an image that appears in the mirror. So with regard to this sense of itself, which independently exists, that we kind of naturally have instinctively,
It becomes very clear when someone actually blames or you for having stolen something which you have not actually. And at that point, when the person says, "You have stolen this thing from me," and you get a sense of "I," when you think, "I have not stolen," there is this very strong sense of "I." Which actually is a very strong sense of this I, which is the object of negation. So when you do this kind of analysis into the self, how it exists, then and you find that this self does not exist independently, and you use that same kind of a logic that you have used to come to this conclusion and to in relation to the aggregates, and when this the same kind of experience doesn't arise in relation to the physical, the body and the mind, the aggregates, then you have sort of realized the selflessness in the sense of selflessness being the self devoid of substantially self-sufficient the existing self, and not the selflessness of person, the subtler one. So even though you may not have developed single-pointed concentration, even without that, you can realize selflessness or emptiness. So sometimes when you check where this I is, who this is, who the person or the I is, and you may find it like you may still have the sense of I am doing this, I am meditating or cultivating bodhicitta, and I have come into this life from the past life, and I'm eating and so forth, I'm thinking. And so sometimes the eye seems to be more aligned with the mind, sometimes with the body. So the eye seems to be there. Unmixed with the body and the mind, whereas the body and mind are mixed as one, as if they are of one entity, the eye seems to be independent. The seventh Dalai Lama, he's only trying to remember, recall some lines from the seventh Dalai Lama's writings. So everything is merely designated by name or words, language and thought, and do not have any objective existence. But to the ordinary beings, to their senses,
they appear to have some kind of objective existence. And so look at that. And this way of appearance of the self is the object of negation. So Kyatup Sangye Ishii has said, So these are different lines that are said by the Kyatup Sangye Ishii and then the seventh Dalai Lama. So he says that he has gained ascertainment or certainty in the infallibility or the deceiving nature of this ultimate reality. And appearance and reality. So when you check into yourself, what are things around you, the things appear to have some kind of objective independent existence. But if you actually try to see whether there is such a thing there, you should be able to find it. If things do have some objective existence, we should be able to find them when we actually look for them. So if things were to have any objective independent existence, then it would be the case that the Arya beings' insight into emptiness is actually destroying the objects. But that is not the case. Things are merely designated. So you should focus all your energy in the beginning to recognize this self, which is the object of negation, very clearly. So this self, which is comprehended or which is apprehended by the innately arising grasping at self, So Ansapa has said, so in this space, which is empty, right from the beginning, all these appearances, diverse appearances of the clouds arise, whereas they all dissipate or disappear into the same space. When you actually analyze or critically with wisdom and how things exist. So to us, the object and the object of negation are mixed. We are not able to make any distinction between these two. Therefore, first, you should, when you actually reject through logic and from your experience the object of negation, then you'll be able to see how things are merely designated. So here we are going through the reasoning to prove emptiness or selflessness, which is called the lack of one and many. So first, we're going through the discerning what is meant by the selflessness of persons. And here, there are four points that we need to go So first one is the recognizing what is meant by the I that is produced in our minds, and the sense of I inborn by the inborn grasping through existence, inherent existence. And then the second point is the essential of recognizing how this inherent existent I must relate to the body and the mind if it exists in the manner of its appearance. Whether it is one with the body and the mind or whether it is different or separate from the body and the mind. So when we are deeply asleep and experience a dream, the false eye exerts a very strong grip on our mind. Look at it close, and I'm reading from some of the texts which touches these points, and look at it closely and ask, where is it? How does it exert its hold? How does it operate and function? This false eye seems to exist independently, inherently as something within the composite of the body and the mind without reliance upon the process of mental labeling or imputation. For example, if we are stumbling in the night and bump into a pillar, we think, a pillar. We have thought or sense of pillarness, of something being there with the ability to occupy its place and exist separate from and independent of our mental imputation and labeling. Similarly, we think that the I exists as something inherent, substantial and concrete, independent of the mental imputation or projection. And then with regard to the essential of recognizing how this inherent exists, I must relate to the body and mind if it exists in the manner of its appearance. If this I that we think inherently exists within the framework of the body and the mind actually does exist in the same manner as it appears, then it must do so either as an entity which is one with them or as an entity which is different from them. This is there is no third possibility. You must think deeply about this and understand how, if it is one with the body and the mind, it cannot be other than them. And if it is other than them, it cannot be one with them. And how this eliminates any other mode of existence of the I. And then the third is the essential of realizing how it cannot exist on the basis of inherent existence, one with the body and the mind. The I, which is the product of the inborn and grasping at true existence, cannot be one with the aggregates of the mind and the body because it cannot exist as one with the body nor as one with the mind.
So
So why can it not exist as inherently one with the body? Because when we say in my body, the very words imply a difference in between I and body. Also, when we think about I and the body, we get a strong sense of there being different. Furthermore, after the body is dead, something travels on in cyclic distance and takes birth, and if I were inherently one with my body, this could not be so. I would die with my body. So you should contemplate these ideas and realize how the I cannot be inherently one with the body. Nor is this I inherently one with the mind, for when we say my mind, the very words imply a difference between I and the mind. And if we think carefully about the I and the mind, we get strong sense of there being different. Also, a person cannot exist without a basis of mind, and if person and mind are the same, this would imply then the person is not based upon but is identical to the mind, and vice versa, meaning that we are left with a person or sentient being not based upon mind, which is impossible. So mainly the reason to establish or prove selflessness is the king of reasoning called dependent origination. So there is nothing which is not dependent on others. And what is dependent is said to be empty. And so because things are dependent, we can talk about causality and dependence and non-dependence are contradictory. So if something exists independently, it doesn't need to depend on others. Therefore, something which depends on others cannot be independent of those other factors. And therefore, since things are dependent, independent existence is something which we actually get the notion because of our illusion. So, the Madhyamaka Avatara says, what is dependent is said to be empty, and that is dependently designated, and that is the middle way. And so there in the 400 verses, says that there is nothing which is not dependent, and therefore there is no self. So the most powerful reasoning to prove selflessness is the reasoning of dependent origination. So when we talk about cause and effect, a cause becomes a cause in relation to an effect which it brings about in the future. And so because of that effect that is yet to come, the thing is called a cause because it gives rise to that. But then the cause and the effect cannot be simultaneously existent. If they were to have any kind of independent inherent existence, then they should be together simultaneously, because they are not dependent on one another, on each other. So when we say something, some effect, some cause gives rise to an effect, there is an action of giving rise to the effect. So although the action of giving rise to the effect is there, the effect is not yet there. And in relation to that effect which is yet to arise, the action of arising is said to be the cause of the effect. And so apart from that, there is no effect and cause. And so apart from being dependently designated, there is nothing which exists inherently or independently, objectively. And if things were to have any objective existence, then they must not depend on anything else. And therefore, we need to know this very well
in order to reject any objectification in things, any objective existence in things. Otherwise, the Savatantrika Madhyamakas do posit some kind of objective existence in things. And therefore, as long as there is some kind of objective existence left and grasping at that is left, then there is all kinds of negative emotions arising in our mind, as it is said by Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna. When the mind has something to nestle in, then how come the rest of the negative emotions not arise in us? And so when you think about the empty nature of things, on the one hand, and you are not so comfortable positing the conventional nature of things, and so vice versa, then you have not still understood the intent of the Buddha, as Master Tsongkhapa says. So with regard to these, the essential realizing, how the eye cannot be different from the mind and the body on the basis of the inherent existence, so when it through one's analysis and meditation on selflessness, when you are able to bring up this conviction that there is nothing else apart from things being empty of such inherent existence, an eye, for example, then which is to say that when as said in the three principal aspects of the path, when the two occurs not successively but concurrently, and the mere sight of an infallible dependent arising gives rise to an ascertainment that destroys the mode of apprehension of the object, then analysis of the view is complete. So around 40 years ago, in Tsongkhapa's commentary to Madhyamaka Avatara, where he says that there is no self apart from the continuity of the aggregates, and therefore the self is merely designated. So I got some sense of selflessness of I. Perhaps at that time I may have gained insight and have actually given a slap on the face of grasping at some kind of substantially existent, self-sufficient I, but not yet gaining insight into the selflessness, the subtler ones. And later, as I kept up with this kind of experience, and then read related teachings more, then there is nothing which exists. Anything that exists must exist by way of convention became more clear. And the fact that the things, what is conventionally established is not undermined by any other conventional knowledge. And then also what is conventionally established is not undermined by the ultimate analysis. These two became more and more clear. So some, after having done some analysis into the selflessness, the view, although they have not yet come to that understanding, the true understanding of selflessness, they think that merely thinking that things do not have any existence, they think they are meditating on selflessness, which is not the right kind of meditation on the view of selflessness.
So, of course, there is a selfless meditation on thoughtlessness in according to the Tantra, which is different. So a similar point is made in this text by the Second Dalai Lama. Some practitioners of this system of meditation think that emptiness means there is no absolute, and there is absolutely no I, and they propagate the view of inherently no I. This misses the point. Others take the I, which is the object of refutation in meditation upon emptiness, and hide it deeply in the recesses of their heart, attacking instead the I, which validly exists on the functional level of truth. This also is a completely mistaken approach. We must isolate the false I from that which conventionally exists and destroy only the false ones. This is the meaning of Buddha's teachings on emptiness. So it is not the case that we should actually stop all the thoughts processes that are in us. So when you develop, for example, the shamatha, in the process of developing it, you need to develop all these different states of mind in order to finally have the experience of the shamatha, the calm abiding or meditative serenity. So there is no stopping thought completely there. So when once you have ascertained the selflessness in your through your analysis, through in when you do analytical meditation, that ascertainment must be carried on during your focusing meditation, when you actually try to meditate on the selflessness of an I. So by following Chitupje's lineage, we actually prove selflessness of a person through these four through this reasoning, which has the four points. So what one needs to understand is that the I does not exist the way it appears So merely saying that the I does not exist the way it appears is not enough. One needs to go through these four points and then reject the actual object of negation itself. So when you do daily yoga practice, it's always better to focus on the focus on the deity and think of emptiness. So when you focus your mind on the selflessness, then you may, to your mind, it may appear that the self exists independently, objectively. But then from your reasoning and conviction, you'll be able to confirm that there is no such an independently existing self. So there are many different systems, it says. But in essence, so we are stopping at this point where the text says, in essence, to put it up, to wrap it up, in essence. So we may finish the fifth Dalai Lama's. We may finish the
versified text on Lambrim, which is the essence of nectar, tomorrow, and then we may be able to start with the Shamar Lamrim, which will, of course, not finish, and we'll continue with the rest of the Lamrim teachings, Shamar Lamrim, and then the Papankava's liberation in the palm of your hand. And so what we must do is actually give thought to these. When we do Daily Yoga practice, we of course do the Six-Session Guru Yoga, and within the context of within that practice, Six-Session Guru Yoga, we can also include the Lamrim practice. So those who have not received highest yoga tantra initiation, whichever daily yoga practice you may be doing, the lower realms, the lower tantras, you can do the same kind of practice within the context of tantra. And then those who have not received any initiation, you may do this kind of practice of Lamrim in connection with the Guru Yoga practice of Master Tsongkhapa, the 100 deities of Dushita, and so forth. And so I too do this. First, I do the screening meditation in connection with the Garden Hajjama, and then I do the Lamrim meditation by doing the foundation of all good qualities. And so whatever we are doing, and whether we are going somewhere or sitting somewhere, or we can actually think about the Lamrim. It's not the case that we have to set some time apart for the Lamrim practice. And if you actually spend your time in the practice of Lamrim day and night, 24 hours can be used. And then even in dream, you may have a dream of Lamrim practice.